Bank is currently a human rights free zone. In its operational policies in particular, it treats human rights more like an infectious disease than universal values and obligations. This is how international financial organizations practice neocolonialism.
Now, to talk more on this, I would like to welcome Mr. C.P. Chandrasekhar. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts in New Delhi, India. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the extended fund facility is meant to resolve the issue of cash flow in Sri Lanka, but the question is cash flow the real cause of the problem?
Well, you know, the extended finance facility is supposed to be not just a cash flow issue. It's supposed to put in place a set of conditions reflected in a letter of intent, which the government concerns provides to the IMF. And we know the kind of conditionality associated with the IMF loans. And if you look at it in practice, what we have is $2.9 billion going into Sri Lanka as part of this agreement if it goes through the board. And what is known is that Sri Lanka's total outstanding debt stock is something like $51 billion. So $3 billion, even if it's going to come through, it's going to come through in a period over of you know, something like 3 to 4 years. And what you have is a large part of this $51 billion having to be paid off over the coming 2-3 years. So I wouldn't even say that this is an effort to resolve a cash flow. What it is really for the IMF to try and tell private financial investors that we are getting this country to adopt a set of policies which would be in keeping with what you think is appropriate. So we are de-risking the environment such that you will come in with additional cash or additional support, essentially, or not additional support, but additional lending. So unless there is a larger package in which not just bilateral lenders, but also private financial firms and bondholders of different kinds come in and work out a rescheduling exercise, it's not going to work. So I wouldn't even say that this is a cash flow adjustment. This is an adjustment. I mean, this is a process of de-risking the environment or attempt at de-risking the environment for international private investors.
Sir, this is the 17th time that Sri Lanka receives aid from the IMF. At this point, we must ask, why do these programs keep failing in reviving the Sri Lankan economy?
So, yeah, that only sort of confirms what I've just said, that essentially, if you have a country which has, ever since the first IMF loan, adopted a set of policies which are in keeping with what the IMF wanted, it was a country which actually was performing quite well, particularly if you look at it in terms of the human development or welfare indicators. Sri Lanka was one of the developing countries across the globe, but definitely in the Asian region, in the Asia-Pacific region, which was performing really well. You take a country like that and put it through a transition, which is a neoliberal transition in terms of economic policy, and you end up with a situation where you don't really resolve the balance of payments difficulties of a country which, it is true, is dependent on a few sources of foreign exchange earnings. I mean, it's dependent on incomes from tourism, it is dependent on to a certain extent on garment exports, and it is dependent on remittances from Sri Lankan workers abroad. That if you have a few sources of income, obviously you're vulnerable. So instead of actually working on a strategy which would help that economy diversify in terms of its ability to be able to earn foreign exchange and diversify such that it can reduce its dependence on imports so that outflows of foreign exchange are lower. If you had a program of that kind, then you shouldn't have had a situation where they have to keep going back to the IMF, where actually you have these 17, I mean, this is the 17, you have 16 different instances in which they've gone. So I would actually say that the reason why the IMF keeps coming back, even though it's very clear that what it tried to do in the past is a failure, is because what it's trying to do is not really put the country on a trajectory which allows it to overcome its structural vulnerabilities and be to a certain extent sort of resilient vis-a-vis balance of payment shocks. But really what it aims to do is to create an environment in which there is a degree of confidence created for international investors to de-risk the environment for international investors, particularly for international lenders. It is in some sense getting the country caught in a debt trap, but in a way in which the losers will not be the international, you know, lenders who, without due diligence, have actually been providing large credits to many countries which are on the verge or actually have defaulted, like Sri Lanka has for the first time. That it really is de-risking these countries to say that you're not going to be the loser. If anybody is the loser, it's going to be the population of the country, in particular, given inequality, the poor populations of these countries.
Sir, it's known that the IMF is notorious for its predatory lending policies that perpetuate financial troubles. So is another deal the solution that Sri Lankans should be seeking?
You see, the point is it's very clear in principle what a country like Sri Lanka needs at the moment, because it is true that it saw a collapse in its foreign exchange reserves because it has elements of balance payments vulnerability, and then a combination of the sudden stop in global economic activity, and particularly on the receipts from tourism, which came as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath, and the response to the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of brutal lockouts or lockdowns all over the world, that it actually, because of that and because of the fact that post the Ukrainian invasion, it's the imports that it was dependent on, both of in particular of commodities like fertilizer, energy, etc., that the dollar prices of these went up quite sharply, it had seen a collapse in its reserves. Okay, so if that be the case, what we need is the following. It basically is a situation where Sri Lanka is saying that, listen, we've accumulated this debt. We are not in a position to be able to find the foreign exchange. It's not that you can print Sri Lankan rupees and meet your debt service commitments. You have to transform your Sri Lankan commodities or Sri Lankan rupees into foreign exchange, into hard currency, to be able to service this external debt. So what is needed is very clear. First, there is need for multilateral and bilateral creditors to actually examine the situation and write off a significant share of debt such so that it becomes feasible to be able to address the debt problem. Secondly, it's necessary for a large number of the private investors who have over a period of time bought into Sri Lankan sovereign bonds to accept a significant haircut, as well as allow for a degree of rescheduling. And third, since even if you manage to restructure and reschedule debt, that doesn't mean Sri Lanka's need for foreign exchange is going to vanish overnight. You need a process by which you could ensure the flow of concessional liquidity to Sri Lanka for a period of time. And finally, in that period of time, you need to put in place a strategy which, as I said, would diversify the economy such that the export earnings become larger and more sustained. And import earnings and import outflows are reduced by actually producing domestically a set of commodities, in particular food, which Sri Lanka tends to import over a period of time. So unless you have this whole package, some debt write-off, some restructuring of debt of private debt involving significant haircuts and rescheduling, some degree of liquidity inflow in concessional terms to allow Sri Lanka over the coming, you know, couple of years or 3-4 years to tide over the difficulties it is facing, and finally, a non-neoliberal development package which allows it to diversify its economic structure so as to be able to reduce its import dependence and increase its export earnings. That is the only way in which you can actually resolve this without going in for another 18th, 19th, 20th or 21st IMF loan.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Chandrasekhar for being on the program. He's an economic columnist, a senior research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, New Delhi, India. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Andrew Fidel Fernando, Colombo-based journalist and author of Upon a Sleepless Isle, slammed the IMF deal with Sri Lanka, stating the country's declining standard of living and costs rise compared to income. Ex-global youth worker and political activist Sankha Chandima Abaya Wardena asked for publishing of the complete Sri Lanka IMF deal, stating that people have a right to know. Joe Wallen, the Telegraph's Southeast Asia foreign correspondent, pointed to the Sri Lanka's borrowing complexities and added that if it is going to get to a sustainable level, Beijing, New Delhi, Tokyo, multilaterals, and global asset managers must all swallow losses.
And that was our episode about the unprecedented and devastating floods in Pakistan and the resulting crises. And also, Sri Lanka's attempt at receiving a loan from the IMF and its impact on the country's economy. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, where welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Dr. Hojatul Islam Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dr. Karimi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Arbain procession or Arbain walk, usually it is from Najaf to Karbala, but most of the time from most regions from Iraq, you know, far distance places, we can say we have so many stations, mawqifs, you know, mawaqif over there, stops, and the people donate or spend their money over there. Now, the main question is this. Isn't it better to spend all this money, for example, to help the poor and the needy in your own country, and instead of going, for example, to a foreign land like Iraq and spend the money over there? What's your answer to that?
The same question is usually asked when it comes to money for Imam Hussein alayhi salam in general. So the question is that why do people spend for the morning sessions for Imam Hussein alayhi salam during the month of Muharram and Safar, and especially people raise the same question about the Arbain procession. So first of all, it's not good to, I mean usually those people who raise this question, they just look at the surface of the happenings. They just see that there are some mawaqif, some stations, as you mentioned. There are some foods and drinks that people go and as if they are enjoying themselves. And they ignore the spiritual dimension of all these happenings. So first of all, the point is that when we analyze the people who take part in these morning sessions in, paying money for these mawaqif, for these stations, we see that the same people are at least among the first people who go on special situations to help other people. So when we are talking about true believers, true mu'mineen, so for example, take the example, the Islamic Republic of Iran. The question is that why these mu'mineen, these believers, pay money for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So when it comes to helping the poor people, the same people are in the first line, at least, to go and, I mean, when there is a flood, for example, the majority of the people who go to help the people are among the same people.
The mobilized forces that go here and there.
What we call it, Urduya Jihadi.
Jihadi camp,
yeah, yes. The volunteer peoples. Okay. I don't want to claim that those who do not pay for Imam Hussein al-Islam do not take part in these occasions. No, we have among them too. But the same people who pay for Imam Hussein al-Islam, the same people also take part in helping the people,
that's
especially
right,
the poor people.
Okay. But since here they're spending the money and the donations are many, you know, they are big in the eyes of the people.
Yeah.
So, wow, how much money is being spent over there? Is better, for example, to spend it here and there on the financial problems of the people of the country.
So the other point is that when we see the reality, again, we see that in these 2 months of Muharram and Safar, in which the mu'mineen, they pay for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the poor people also enjoy a lot. Those people who cannot afford for their life, at least in these 2 months, through the help of the mu'mineen, the faithful, they also enjoy. I mean,
yes,
they are able to take part in these morning ceremonies,
yes,
and take benefit from the spiritual dimension of it, and also from the food and drink.
As you can see, there are so many stops now, for example, in the holy city of Qom, distributing foods, distributing free tea, free food, and something like that. And it's not only limited to the world of Islam. If you just look at the work of the churches all around the world, or the synagogues, you know, among the Jews, they have a special day for helping the poor and the homeless and the needy, and give away in the way of God in charity, mm-hmm. and they have all these sessions too. Okay.
Yeah. The other point is that when we refer to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, of course, this answer mm-hmm. is based on whether we believe in the sayings of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. Of course, as Shia, we do believe in them. According to the narrations, whatever you spend for the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, would come back to you and would be doubled. I mean, would be it is as if you have not spent anything. Not only that, you would receive more. So, for example, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says that if you go to visit Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, your rizq, your sustenance would be increased by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Whatever you spend for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam would come back to you. So this is the reality of the world.
That's right.
Of course, from the materialistic understanding, this mm-hmm. is not understandable.
Okay.
But as believers, as Muslims, we do believe in these narrations, according to which if we pay money for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it would, at least the same would come back to us. So again, we have spent for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the same money comes back, and okay. we can send it for other purposes, including to help the poor
And believe
people.
Me, it is not only the personal benefits over here. It is mostly, I think, these donations, these, we can say, nuzurat, are all concerned in the collective and the societal, the social format, and the people are looking for reforming the society. And I think there is no personal benefit. At least, I think that the people are not spending for their own personal mm-hmm. interest.
Exactly.
It is not like, for example, putting your money in a bank or something like that. No, it's not.
Yeah, with your point, let me go to a deeper understanding mm-hmm. of the Arba'in walk and Arba'in procession. As I mentioned, those people who may have a kind of materialistic understanding of these events, they may just see some people walking and eating and drinking yes. and going through some difficulties and mm-hmm. problems and coming back. Mm-hmm. This is a very shallow understanding of this procession. The point is that we do believe in the fact that the ziyarah of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt in general and the ziyarah of Arba'in in specific and Arba'in walk and procession has a kind of a spiritual dimension to it. So you can ask all the people who have taken part in these procession, are you going there for food or drink or just walking? This is not the case. Yes. I mean, the main purpose of mourning for Imam al-Hussein, the same point is about those people who take part in mourning ceremonies.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. So through mourning ceremonies, people come to know the reality of the religion, because in all these ceremonies, we have some religious lectures given by the scholars. So for sure, and this is a reality that most of the people only through, during the month of Muharram and Safar, they have the chance to take part in these lectures and take benefit from the scholars.
That's right.
So according to the saying of one of the scholars, when you go to ziyarah of Arba'in, you become a human being, spiritually speaking.
Yes.
You come back, and then you have a new understanding
That's
of
right.
the religion. I mean, you have increased in terms of spirituality. Now, it's much more probable
That's
for
right.
a person like that to help the poor people
okay.
as well.
Okay.
So
it is not like a carnival or a happy
point.
Celebration
exactly.
because we have so many outstanding, for example, big processions, carnivals, and happy celebrations on different occasions all across the world, you know, in their calendar. But this is not something for a happy joy or enjoyment or amusement. It is something, as you said, a kind of a spiritual wayfaring.
And I believe that no one can claim that I've been in Arbain procession and I didn't go through any kind of problem and difficulty. Yes, yes. There are difficulties for all the people.
Yes.
I mean, we have hot weather, you may not find a good place to rest, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So it's not the matter of, I mean, materialistic enjoying of the food and drink. No,
okay.
I mean, you need to walk for 2-3 days and you may suffer. But the point is that people who come back from that spiritual journey, they, as I mentioned, they change a lot in terms of spirituality. So these people are more probable now on to help the poor people compared to the people who have not gone to this journey or the same people before going to the journey. So my point is that although money is spent, but the same people who join this procession, they have more chance.
That's right.
They find it more, I mean, they found themselves more responsible regarding the poor people.
And at the same time, since the facilities are more, the donations are more, and the states, I mean, the administrations of different countries are spending money on that, it would become very much easier for some of the even poor people in order to attend, to pay ziyarah to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Since, for example, during the ordinary days of the day, it's been difficult financially for some of the people to coming from far lands to Karbala. So during these days, it's very much facilitated and easier. And this is a good point. I think this is a mass help and contribution to the poor people of the society.
And if I may go to even a deeper understanding of this ziyarat, I mean, the morning sessions for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the Arba'in walk, you, I mean, rightly refer to the international aspect to it. Nowadays, we have people coming from different countries to this Arba'in procession. So we know that one of the reasons, one of the main reasons for poverty and injustice is the oppression, is injustice.
Yes.
And we can claim that the main message of the uprising of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is to raise and have a kind of uprising against oppression and injustice.
That's right.
So if we have a deep understanding of this ziyarat, this, I mean, morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, people who come to know Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they come to know the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And one of the main messages is to have a kind of rising against oppression and the oppressive systems all over the world.
That's all right.
So to have a kind of deep understanding of this ziyarat, it may deepen the understanding of the people about the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And in the long term, I believe that it can help the people take, I mean, get rid of this oppression and injustice in different parts of the world.
That's right.
And it may have different examples. So to put it in a nutshell, let me just share one narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in this regard. He says that ziyara of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is like preparing 1,000 people, 1,000 warriors for a war. This is a very, profound narration of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And one of the ways of it is that through going to ziyara of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we receive this message of resisting the oppression, resisting the injustice, which nowadays we see all over the world. And I believe that if people take part in this Arba'in walk and procession, not only that, in all these morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they can benefit from this message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
It is really, as you said, an international ceremony now. All the people all across the world, you know, now that we are talking, they have started their walk towards Karbala maybe 1-2 months in advance on foot. And this is really praiseworthy. And what is important is that as we have in our ahadith and narrations, paying ziyarah to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, if it is with less joy and more difficulty, it will be really more helpful in the spiritual purification of the person because of the hardships of Imam al-Hussein.
Yeah, and there are many messages, as I mentioned, spiritual messages in this walk.
Right.
One of them is brotherhood and helping others.
Right.
All the people who take part in this procession, they agree that we feel a new feeling of brotherhood in this journey. All the people try their best to help other people to have a kind of self-sacrifice. So, as I mentioned, these people are affected by this journey
to
later when they come back to practice the same in their normal life as well.
Even the non-Muslims, the Christians and the Jews are attending, and there are so many video footage of these outstanding fathers, sisters, brothers, all across the believers and the truth seekers all across the world, you know, on this day. May Allah help all of them, and may Allah help us to attend this Arbaeen procession this year, inshallah. Thank you much, Sheikh Dr. Hojjatul Islam Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding spending on donations on the day of Arbaeen. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications on the day of Arbaeen, especially those people, those walkers who are attending the Arbaeen procession from Najaf to Karbala. Do not forget us in your supplications and spiritual wayfaring. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Disorganized bands of mourners wishes protest the cruelty and injustice
these demonstrations must go on. Be not fooled by these riders, these men who by different names and ideologies try to take everything away from you, but they see that these Ashura mornings, these gatherings for lamentation, recitation of miseries of the oppressed and voicing the crimes of the tyrant place the people against the oppressors.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the resurrection and the hereafter. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that you must remember that all of us have another day, the hereafter. Do not doubt this. We have a day of reckoning before us, and everything will be considered and calculated on that day. Man himself should give an account of his acts. On that day, hands shall testify, eyes shall testify. On that day, man shall take account of himself. We have such a day. Now, in this part of his speech, he is talking about a very important belief that we as a Muslim and most of the religions in the world, they have this belief that there is a day of hereafter. And all our actions that we perform, we are accountable for those actions. Therefore, we must remember that day, because those who remember that day, their actions are different. When they perform something, they consider the hereafter and they know the consequences which they're going to pay. Either the consequences which are going to happen in this world and ultimately the consequences that we will be considered accountable for that in hereafter. Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala When we help someone, it will help us in hereafter. When we oppress someone, obviously this oppression, we need to answer. If someone does injustice in this world, he has to answer in the other world for what he has been doing. And therefore, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even in the Quran, when we read the first chapter, Surah Al-Hamd, he says, Maliki Yawmiddin, he is the master of the day of resurrection, means the day when everyone will be gathered in front of him, and the blessings that he has given us, we will be accountable for all of that. And our all actions, these actions that we perform, our hands, eyes, our legs, our body will testify every single thing. That is the day when nothing is hidden. And all the actions that we used to perform, we will see all those things happening in front of us. Whatever we have done, there is a book in which everything is written. And therefore, Imam Khomeini also say that we must remember. Why? Because we are accountable for what we are doing. Therefore, we need to make our actions right. We must reform ourselves before that day comes. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Economic Divide.
The weaponization of water. Turkey flexes its muscles over Syria and Iraq. Is Turkey actually doing that? Well, Syrians and Iraqis think so. More importantly, they are saying that they're suffering immensely as a result of this. But why is Turkey cutting off the water supplies from the important Euphrates and Tigris rivers? That is what we're going to try to find out in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the water crisis that has been ongoing for quite some time. The Euphrates and Tigris rivers are the source of the conflict. Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. What types of tensions will erupt out of that is the key question. Then, the accusation leveled against Turkey, which is using water as a weapon. Is Turkey weaponizing water? Why would it do that? Is it trying to project power? And what is the statement from Turkey a while ago where it said water for oil in terms of a swap with the Persian Gulf countries? We're going to take a close look at that. Also, the dangers of war over water, water scarcity, in which people may go and have an uprising because of their situation. Water diplomacy is the only way to go about that.
The water crisis is now a global problem, affecting not only West Asia, but also traditionally water-rich regions like Europe and West China. The crisis is mainly attributed to climate change and global warming. But when it comes to Syria and Iraq, one critical factor should be taken into account: Turkey's increasing involvement in manipulating the region's rivers and water resources. The current crisis has a long history of political geostrategic interests, alliances, and enmities. The main cause of the current mess and water dispute between Turkey and Syria stems from the crisis that prevailed after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the emergence of modern Turkey. Back then, Ankara was told by Allied powers to consult with Iraq and Syria over the hydraulic works.
When it comes to the issue of water, we are not out to actually accuse Turkey of being guilty on this. We are exploring and we're looking at the different ways as to why Turkey has been leveled this accusation. And that is the approach that we used actually to go after online posts on this, which hopefully sheds light about what people think about this. For example, post had this to say: Turkish fascist state continues to use water as a weapon against Syria. So that's one view, a negative view on Turkey. Next, Syrian parliament said that it had sent 57 letters to international and Arab organizations and parliaments calling them to condemn Turkey's ongoing water cutoff to Syria's Hasakah. And our final post on this issue: Turkey's southeastern Anatolia irrigation project, for example, is a series of 22 dams that diverts much of the Euphrates, and it will leave Iraq with less than 50% of the water that it historically got, says Azam Awash, who's the director of Nature of Iraq. So those were some of the views, pretty much one-sided in this case. Let's find out if our guests are in that camp or the opposite camp. All right, those were some of the online posts on this. Actually, they were quite one-sided in terms of the way they viewed Turkey. Let's find out what our guests think. Let me introduce our first guest. Erman Çete joins us. He's an investigative journalist and a researcher who actually is the author of the article from thecradle.com titled "The Weaponization of Water, Turkey Flexes Its Muscles Over Syria and Iraq." Erman Çete, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what Turkey is doing, and based on what you have written in your article, you've accused them of flexing its muscles over Syria and Iraq. You talk about the Euphrates, which is the source of the current and future conflicts, as you have described, between Turkey and its neighbors, and how Ankara actually wants to project its power in the region. I mean, explain to us if really Turkey is guilty of that, because there are some who obviously reject that. Turkey obviously is one of them. And basically, has Turkey weaponized water for its political objectives? And what can those objectives be?
Yes, Turkey has rejected
the allegations about it has been using the Euphrates and Tigris rivers for decades against its neighbors such as Iraq and Syria, claimed that if Damascus does not cut their relationship with the PKK, the Turkish government could and would cut the Euphrates River's water, so Syria will be damaged. And there has been also lots of evidence about Turkish politicians' claims about Iraqi collusion between the PKK. The real question is for Turkey, those governments, those countries, Iraq and Syria, have been harboring the PKK, and they use the river, the water issue, as a threat against those countries.
All right, that's what the author of this article thinks, Mr. Erman Çetet. Let's bring in Aurora Sotimano. Aurora Sotimano is a political scientist and a senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the School of International Relations, also a lecturer at the Faculty of Political Science, International Studies University, UNINT, who joins us from Torino, Italy. Welcome, Aurora. Turkey is accused of claiming that it is actually using water for its own benefit by controlling the waters of the Euphrates and the Tigris at the expense of Iraq and Syria. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that Turkey is using that to exert power, where at the same time it has also been accused of disposing industrial and municipal waste into the water? What are Turkey's gains by doing this to Syria and Iraq, do you think?
Yes. About pollution, I think that in generally speaking, pollution is a more of a sort of a technical problem, in the sense that because of the scarcity of water, low levels of water means that the concentration of chemicals, of organic waste, of whatever pollutant there is higher in the water. So I don't see Turkey purposely, you know, trying to poison water going down to Syria and Iraq. This said, of course, Turkey is using water for agricultural purposes primarily, and the use of agricultural watering means that clean water is taken from the Euphrates into the Ataturk basin and other basins, used for agriculture, and then the refluent, the flow, is taken back into the Euphrates and back into Syria, remains, which is already polluted by agricultural fertilizers and these kind of things within Turkey.
It's time now for our Info News section of the program. This is where we review economic news from around the world. Well, this piece of news was somewhat devastating, though it wasn't presented that way, but the outcome will be. And it's all about the Russian oil prices and how there's a cap on it now. The G7 has unveiled that plan to enforce this Russian oil price cap. Now, Russia will not sell its oil at those prices, which brings about the question, will Europe's economy take more of a beating? Well, that should be a natural outcome. Has Europe thought about that? Only time will tell. On to our next story, India's economy. Let's find out how it is. This piece of news said that it has grown by 13.5%. That's right, 13.5%. And at the same time, the news says it has missed its target. Well, the jump came because of the low base of the previous quarter. And as a result of that, economists have cautioned that there's actually going to be a slowdown. But 13.5%, that's a great increase, don't you think? All right, on to our next story. The UK is in the news these days quite a bit in terms of its economy, but it has taken a double whammy. The UK energy price cap has now tripled, and the price of gas, as a result, roughly by 266%, it has increased in the past 12 months. Add to that soaring inflation, energy costs will leave millions who are going to live without basic dignity. That's how this piece of news was actually covered. So it'll be interesting to see how this is going to pan out. I mean, without immediate government action, basically 12 million households will be hit by fuel poverty in the UK this winter. 42% of all households in the UK is what that translates to, or 28 million people. Our final piece of news regards the Iran JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions relief talks. And this piece of news said, no, Iranians are not negotiating from a weak economic position. In fact, it said its economy grew 4.3% last year, which then calls into question, for example, the U.S.'s hawks view that maximum pressure is beating Tehran into submission. Those were the news that we picked for you.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It is time now for our in-depth section. Water is scarce in the West Asia region. Water is scarce actually around the world. Anyways, Turkey knows that, and there are question marks around how it is handling water resources when it comes to rivers like the Tigris and the Euphrates, not to mention the massive dams that it has built around the Tigris in particular. Okay, first let's take a look at what is going on. Now, the source of the problem. The Euphrates-Tigris basin is shared between Turkey, Syria and Iraq, with Iran comprising parts of the Tigris basin. But the dams that Turkey has built, it has given Turkey, as an effect, the leverage to control the water flow, meaning that it can limit the volume of water that comes flowing through these dams. Okay? So that sets the scenario. Moving on, as such, in addition to Turkey's moves there, Syria is experiencing not only climate change, which is resulting in a drought, but also because of Turkey's dam building. 5 million people are suffering. So you have that occurring, the impact of what Turkey is doing, along with climate change. Two of Syria's dams are facing closures, which are responsible for generating electricity for 3 million people. Next up, we move on to Iraq. Iraq, as a result of what Turkey is doing, is not in good shape either. Actually, the drought there, again, as a result of climate change, along with Turkey's move, has impacted 7 million Iraqis. They are suffering as a result. So combine that with Syria, you have 12 million people whose lives are at risk. Next, some of the areas which has been affected in terms of the sectors include the following: farmland, obviously agriculture, fisheries, power production, and of course drinking water. Now, how can people survive in these conditions? Now, meanwhile, Turkey is sitting pretty well when it comes to its water resources. When it comes to percent originating from within its borders, it's 98%, but outside of its borders, in terms of the water, it only is in need of 1.5%. Now, by comparison, take a look at Syria. Originating outside of its borders for water that it needs, it's 72% reliant, while within it's 28%. And our last graph is Iraq, where you have 61% originating outside of its borders, while 39% Iraq relies on inside its border. All right, let's get a breakdown. Rejoining us is Armen Cheta, the investigative journalist and researcher, whom we told you is the author of the article from thecradle.com, Weaponization of Water. Armen, welcome back. When we take a look at what Turkey has done in terms of its intentions, there are geopolitical goals that obviously it has in mind. One of them is weakening the Syrian government in this case. What do you think is going on there, especially in comparison or in the same context of Israel, who is after weakening the Syrian government when it comes to, for example, water?
The Israeli government also supports the instabilization of Syria. It's it has invaded it in 1967, and it also annexed some part of Golan Heights. So also the Syrian people cannot use and cannot claim its sovereignty on the natural resources of the Golan Heights. And the Golan Heights is very rich with respect to natural resources. So what Israel wants or has been wanted for decades on Syria is also, or not just Syria, the whole Arab land, the whole Palestine, is to claim its occupation on the Arabs' natural resources. So it's a part of Zionist strategy to weaken the Arab governments, the Arab countries, and Syria is one of the most respected supporters of the resistance against Zionist occupation.
All right, let's find out what Aurora Sati Mano thinks. She's the political scientist and senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies who rejoins us. Aurora, welcome back. Taking a look at Turkey, we have talked about how it is flexing its muscles, so to speak, when it comes to the way that it's using water as a weapon, as many have accused Turkey of doing. Is that the case? How is it affecting countries like Iraq and Syria, for example, which in this case in point are suffering as a result of water shortages? Is it only because of Turkey and what it's doing vis-a-vis the dams that it has constructed, for example?
Yes, definitely I would say that water is the source of conflict now, and it will be in the future, maybe even more. It has been in the past. So Turkey has tried to impose its will over hostile groups in northern Syria by, you know, manipulating water. And Turkey is also using its control of water to put pressure on the Assad government in order to accede to his vision, to Erdogan's vision of northern Syria. But to answer more properly, we should take a step back and look at historically. In the past, water policies have been always enmeshed with other political confrontations. From the 70s, basically, from the beginning of the GAP, the Great Anatolian Project, which consisted of, I think, 21 dams on the Euphrates and one on the Tigris. So since the 70s and during the 80s and 90s, links between water negotiation and politics, higher politics, regional relations, have been unmistakable.
Turkey has rejected the claim that it's using water as a weapon, and it says that it's working with Syria, Iraq, and Iran for the fair distribution of water resources. However, evidence suggests otherwise. A 2002 fact-finding mission said that Turkey was providing 300 cubic meter per second from Jarablus River instead of 500 cubic meters that was originally agreed upon. It is now predicted that the West Asia region is likely to witness more water-related crises in the near future, and Turkey's ambitious plans to monopolize water resources will give it a strategic weapon against its rivals and neighbors.
The issue of water in any part of the world is crucial for survival, but in the West Asia region, it is a matter of life and death. Turkey knows this, and the verdict is out on whether it is using it as a political tool or not. Many have concluded that it is. Turkey's position on the Euphrates and the Tigris is that these rivers are transboundary, means that they are rivers that cross at least one political border. Therefore, Ankara sees the two rivers as a uniform basin and part of its sovereignty. Iraq and Syria, however, see the rivers as international and separate entities. It's no surprise that this difference in the point of views needed a mediator to solve the conflict. This happened in 1980. After a joint security agreement with Syria, Turkey said any commitment by Turkey would be conditional to Syria's loyalty to the agreement. But then things hit a snag when Turkey threatened Damascus with severing its access to the Euphrates. The reason? Turkey's perceived notion of Damascus' support for PKK, which Ankara views as a terrorist organization. Turkey issued a statement soon after saying that Turkey's resources are Turkey's. The oil resources are theirs. We do not say we share their oil resources, and they cannot say they share our water resources. To make matters worse, Turkey was accused of environmental damage when it decided to take things a step further in this dispute. Turkey was accused of dumping industrial and municipal waste into rivers, hurting Iraqis and Syrians as a result, hurting things like irrigation use. Last but not least, there may be another reason why Turkey is keen on using water resources as a political tool against Syria. For that to be understood, we need to go as far back as the year 2004. Israel and Turkey signed an agreement whereby Turkey would sell water off the Manavgat River to Israel. The sale of Turkish water to Israel, however, failed. The recent improvement in diplomatic ties between Israel and Turkey gives rise to the possibility that since their interests converge in Syria, there may be reason for both wanting to keep the Syrian government weak. There's no credible evidence, however, to prove this theory. That does it for this segment of the program.
This is the situation when it comes to this water conflict. In West Asia, the water conflict has occurred when downstream countries are weak and unable to adapt to water scarcity, and where the relative strength is extremely low at this point for them to retain the water. The only solution that exists is for diplomacy to prevail. Some call it water diplomacy, which would involve Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Turkey once had the motto, zero problems with neighbors. It's time that it acts on that regarding this issue. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mika Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فألقى موسى عصاه فإذا هي تلقف ما يأفكون
Then Moses threw his staff, and at once it devoured what they falsified.
فألقي السحرة ساجدين